Welcome everybody to All About Symbian Insight Podcast number 163, recording this on Tuesday the 26th of April 2011. I'm Steve Litchfield and I'm back after a week away. With me down in Sussex I have...
Rafe Blanford.
And up in Hull...
David Gilson. Hello everybody.
And saving the best to last, up in Scotland I have...
Hello, here are the votes of the Scottish jury.
Oh dear, he's in Eurovision mode already.
Not quite, I've got another week.
Yeah, be prepared for a rash of Eurovision stories and all about Symbian in about a week's time. You have been warned. But first, we have some Nokia results. It was time for Nokia to announce its quarter one 2011 results. I'll just give you the summary and a few impressions, then I'll leave it to Rafe to add the analysis. I'm hearing two different stories, you see. On the one hand, I see the bear figures, and Rafe's headline was Beats Expectations. We have the smartphone sales, that's Symbian-powered smartphones, 24 million sold, 24 million, almost a quarter of 100 million just in the one quarter. So we're still on track for about 100 million per year. And that was up 13% year on year. Analysts had device margins estimated at 8.5%. They actually came in at 9.8%. So Nokia's share price went up. So there seems to be some cause there for at least mild optimism. And yet at every turn, I see people like Tommy Ahern and our friend over there, the analyst, Rafe, saying this is an absolute disaster for Nokia. And so which is true? Are they beating expectations or is it an absolute disaster?
We have to consider that the expectations were pretty low, but yes, they did manage to beat them. I think perhaps more of a concern was there was a tough outlook for the quarters ahead. I actually think, you know, in terms of sales and margins, the results were, you know, much better than most people were expecting. You touched on the margins, but it was similar for overall revenue and profit as well. In terms of the smartphone sales, I actually think they took probably more of a dip than some people were expecting. Although, as you noted, they were up sort of 15% year on year, that's, you know, against industry growth of 50% or more, and that was actually down quarter on quarter 14%. That said, you typically do get a dip, you know, following on from the Christmas sales, but it was certainly more severe this year. And I think that's really just an indication that Symbian is having trouble being competitive, particularly at the high end, and I'm sure Stephen Elot will point at this towards evidence as to why there's a need to switch away from Symbian to Windows Phone. You know, the debate on that will go on and on. But
can I just interrupt very quickly, Ray? Because the 24 million smartphones sold in the quarter, okay, they were down quarter on quarter because they had a strong, Nokia had a strong last quarter last year. But just look in perspective, 24 million sold, this is hardly being uncompetitive and being an absolute disaster. Both Apple or RIM, either of them, would give their eye teeth to sell 24 million smartphones in a quarter. They're way, way down the chart. And you have to add all of the Android phones from all of the other manufacturers together worldwide to be able to beat that figure from Nokia. So, yes, I know there are trends here and there's plenty to analyse, but let's not kid ourselves that this is a complete disaster and that Nokia aren't selling anything.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, as I say, you do have to put it in its proper context. And people who sit there and say, you know, total catastrophe, Nokia is a complete disaster, is just not true. They are continuing to sell very significant numbers of smartphones. I think the issue is, you know, looking ahead, how long will they keep on doing that? And people particularly look at something like the market share. So that's about 26%. That's down 5% quarter on quarter. More significantly, it's down 15% year on year. So what that means is the proportion of smartphones that Nokia is selling is actually getting less compared to the rest of the market. And so that's where the idea that they're doing particularly badly is coming from. Of course, they remain the biggest smartphone manufacturer by some way. But the question, I think, in a lot of people's minds is, you know, what will happen to that market share trend? Will it level out? Will it go up? Will it go down? And I think in the next few quarters, we'll probably see possibly further declines. And then the, you know, hope of Nokia is that with Windows Phone, it will switch back up again. You know, that's all open to debate, as I say. But that's why there's so much, I think, negativity around. Because compared to the rest of the market, its smartphone sales aren't growing in a healthy way. But we shouldn't take anything away from Nokia. At the same time, there are still millions and millions of Symbian devices out there, and they will continue to sell more. I mean, they will comfortably be the second biggest platform this year. I mean, you mentioned Android. I mean, looking at our figures, you know, our estimates, this is the very first quarter that Android has sold more phones than Symbian. And, you know, even something like the iPhone coming in behind, it's at about the 18 million level. So, you know, that's a 6 plus million difference before you get to Symbian, and that's just in one quarter. So I think, yeah, you know, you're right to sort of just put a shot across my bow there. So it isn't all necessarily doom and gloom. I mean, there are some interesting other bits of the results in it, in terms of things like the average selling price. That was down slightly, suggesting continued price erosion. That's really just saying it continues to be very competitive. Well, that's what we're expecting from the mobile space at the moment. You know, there were the optimistic numbers on OviStore with the 5 million downloads a day. Actually doing pretty well. You know, it's certainly getting within reach of the other app stores in terms of, you know, proportion. It remains the third biggest app store. But I think it probably surprised a lot of people just how many downloads are going through OviStore. There were a couple of interesting things I picked up in the conference call, and one of which was Nokia said they saw no sudden change in consumer perception around Symbian after the February 11th announcement. What this means is that sort of your average person on the street isn't sort of sitting, going, Symbian's dead, I don't want to buy those phones anymore. And we had that as a very strong message come through from some of the media marketing. We said at the time it's probably a bit unlikely because people didn't follow it that closely. And that does kind of confirm what we were saying there, albeit with sort of internal Nokia data. So some people say you need to take that with a pinch of salt. They also said they're not going to announce specific shipment dates on Windows Phone products until they're close to the shipment date. Again, that's sort of following on with a pattern they've said before, you know, trying to reduce the gap between announcement and shipping. I think we'll get onto this later because there's another news story to do with Windows Phone. But again, they are trying to launch one this year, but the majority of it's going to be 2012. They also talked about the problems of dual SIM products having an impact on sale on mobile phones. And certainly you can see if you look into the numbers, there's some concern around mobile phones, although perhaps not quite as much as I was suggesting in the last time we talked about the results. And they're saying dual SIM will ship by the end of Q2 and further device later in the year. So it probably means Q2 is going to be more of the same there. And actually, as I said early on, that's what the outlook was about, as saying that, you know, because of this transition and because also there are sort of more product launches weighted towards the second half of the year, Nokia really expecting Q2 and Q3 to be quite grim. So I suspect what we'll see in the next two set of results is probably more of the same that we're seeing here, perhaps with sort of lower profits and lower margins. And they did offer quite wide range of guidance, which is unusual for a company because they try to you know, narrow it down as much as possible. I think they said between 6% and 9%, which is, you know, pretty big range of figures, and that probably reflects the competitive pricing pressures as well as a certain amount of uncertainty in the market. But I think the message to take away from this is that Nokia was actually doing a little better than the market was expecting to do in results. You have to set that in context and say it's, you know, they're still facing a real problem, but aren't perhaps doing as bad as, you know, everyone thought. So that's good news in that sense. And moving forward to later in the year, we're expecting to see more of the same, and that's not really a surprise. We always knew this transition period was going to be pretty grim in terms of looking at pure results. So I think the interesting thing will be whether Nokia can sort of beat these market expectations of, you know, what is already in one sense low expectations. And if they can do that, I think, you know, they will be able to sort of maintain the share price and keep analysts on side as they move through this transition period.
I think it's important to remember that what we have here in these figures is the dichotomy that any business has, be it long-term and trends and short-term and immediate numbers. We've talked a lot about trends. Nokia can see it going down. You know, there's more smartphones being sold. Market share is constantly shifting. Android is on the climb. And that's important for laying out long-term strategy. And that's what CEO's meant to do. He's meant to look long-term. But at the same time, these figures saw a snapshot of Nokia. And to switch over to physics, there's no acceleration in any of these numbers. This is where the platforms are now. Now, that means everything that's happened before has affected these figures. Everything that's going to happen in the heads, it doesn't matter. These are the figures where they are now. And short-term traders rely on the now. And certainly, you know, right now, I think Nokia are in a bad position here because these snapshot of numbers appear to be weak. And yes, it's nice to talk about trends and strategy and so on. But, you know, in the immediacy, Rafe, maybe you can probably address this one. In the immediacy, how do we relate to these figures?
Well, in the immediacy, as I was talking about, yes, they do reflect pretty poor results for Nokia. And I mean, you're right, they represent a snapshot, but you can also see the trend lines from what's going on before. And I think there'll be a much graver concern here if there hadn't been a February 11th strategy announcement saying this is what we're going to do, regardless of whether you perceive that to be the right thing to do or the wrong thing, or, you know, not quite the right mix. I think a lot of the market's going, right, you know, there is a change ahead, and we've got to let Nokia get through that. And so actually one of the more important parts of the results here was less the numbers, you know, because as I said, they did beat expectations. It was the sort of talk that was going on about what's going on ahead. And Nokia are very careful to say, you know, the transition's on track, as we'll get onto it in a minute. You know, they have signed a definitive agreement with Microsoft. And all of those factors sort of add together, you know, the outlook is almost more important. And, you know, that's why we did hear some discussion about reduction in operating costs. You know, Stephen Elop said they're going to knock €1 billion off operational costs or operational expenditures, I think it was by 2013, and that's from now, and that reflects the decreased investment, particularly around Symbian, but also other areas. And yes, that does mean job losses and various things like that. And so in that sense, you know, there is, you know, some quite grim news all in this. But you're also right to say that yes, there is a sort of look ahead here, which has been is slightly unusual. Often we get a focus on the immediate results, but I think some of the financial reaction, some of the commentators' reaction here, is predicated upon essentially saying, yes, these are poor results for Nokia, they beat expectations, but what's really important is we can look ahead a couple of quarters, or actually more like a year and a half, and see that Nokia have a plan in place. And that's perhaps why there was less negativity in the share price this time around than there has been on previous sets of results.
Speaking of the analysts, Rafe, do they need to believe both the short and long term? And was maybe Nokia's problem that they only believed one side of the coin and not the other side previously?
Well, I mean, it depends which analysts you talk about, because some of them look very closely at the financial figures and, you know, base their modelling off that. And that's where a lot of the kind of funds, you know, do their modelling, and that's how they work out things. And I think they didn't necessarily have the long-term belief, whereas the mobile analysts were almost the other way around. You know, they saw a short-term issue, but maybe were more optimistic about the long-term. So I think it's difficult to talk about them in one group. You have to bear in mind that, you know, there are many, many people looking at these results and they all have a slightly different take on them.
Rafe mentioned there the definitive agreement has been signed between Nokia and Microsoft, and we'll come back to the Windows Phone chat a bit later in this podcast. Elsewhere in the world, Nokia has been rather impressing people. So the word world rather relevant there. This is Ovi Maps 3D, running in web browsers at the moment, but no doubt at some point to come to the smartphones as well. Basically available for 20 cities around the world, including London, San Francisco, New York, that sort of thing. Basically, you have multiple images per block, per building. So someone mentions up to 1,000 images of a different area, up to 100 different angles per building, and with the capture devices capturing one image a second, which is a phenomenal amount of photographic detail. And then the software automatically stitches these together so that in real time, in your web browser, you can now browse into the Ovi Maps database of where the photo with the points of interest, with the location of everything, with the photographic detail applied. And you really can immerse yourself as you swoop through a city, viewing every single building in more or less full 3D. It's very, very impressive. Now, I would say, though, that the fact that they've only done it for 20 cities, and the fact they've only done street-level view, where you can actually go right down to street level and look at buildings from all angles, that's only for 5 cities. I mean, we really are talking about a huge amount of data here, a huge amount of detail. It's going to take them a long, long time to expand that level of detail for full 3D. It also requires a huge amount of bandwidth and a huge amount of processing power, which is why it's not on the smartphones yet. But I can see the potential, guys. I'm if you look at the demo videos, if you play with it for yourself, you think, wow, this is where computer mapping should be, where the entire world is virtual. You can swoop around, see any street anywhere in the world from any angle in as much detail as you want. It's almost as good as being there. But the barriers to getting there are huge in terms of bandwidth and data and capture and processing power and RAM. I think we're getting a glimpse here of something that will be on everybody's phones maybe in 10 years' time and everybody's desktops in about 2 or 3 years' time. Have any of you tried it? Do you want to leap in with an impression?
I think this is an interesting approach to doing things. I was surprised when I saw the news on this that it wasn't actually coming from Navtech, because when I was at Nokia World last year, Navtech were doing a demo of LiDAR mapping, which is range finding with lasers, and they were taking precise measurements of positions of buildings and then mapping photos on. So this is yet another approach to doing things. I'm interested in the Navtech approach, because you do actually get hard data on public structures.
Yeah, just to add a bit of detail there, what you're getting with this sort of 3D maps effect is they're combining photos from various places, but a lot of it is, you know, aerial photography and then overflowing. But I think, as I'm right in saying, some street stuff as well. Steve mentioned Street View. That's actually kind of a separate product. There's almost this 3D view and then the street level view. The street level view data is being collected by Navtech. And then David there was talking about the kind of the LiDAR view. That's actually also captured at street level. So what we're likely to see in the future is a combination of that LiDAR that he was talking about together with the 3D, with the street level photos combined to produce a similar photorealistic model. But this would be from ground level, whereas the 3D view is effectively a sort of bird's eye view. And I think Steve and David both are, you know, really impressive product. This, if you've got a computer and bandwidth able to go through it fast enough, it's really quite amazing the way you can sort of fly through a city in 3D. And I think, you know, really a step beyond anything else I've seen in terms of visualization that's accessible to anyone through a browser, at least. You know, it does call to mind things like Google Earth, and there are a couple of other similar products, but the photorealism on this does take it a further step forward. And what it really just illustrates, I think, quite nicely, is how important Nokia regards location as a technology going forward. And as Steve said right at the beginning, you know, this is on the desktop now, but, you know, it will develop over the next couple of years. You'll get more data in, and it will eventually get onto the phone. And I think the combination of this, and then you start to bring in things like the augmented reality views, as the location then becomes much more central to the entire sort of being of a mobile device. And this is really the way to very effectively link the digital and the physical worlds together. So that's why I think it's so interesting to look at this. Quite apart from just the cool factor, you can see that this is a much more intuitive way to sort of interact with the world through a device like this, when you have this much more realistic, if you like, view of the world. And this digital recreation really is, I mean, I was really impressed by this. And you know, it's not often you open something up and you go, wow. And, you know, the amount of data available, and Steve said it's only 20 cities, but I'm sure that will expand with time.
Yeah, and I think this is a great example of why phones need things like dual core processors and 3D accelerators. Apart from just playing whizzy games, this is the first thing. I mean, I dread to think about the amount of power it will use, but I just wanted to speak to the practical benefits of this. I mean, it isn't just a novelty item. I remember when I was preparing to come down to London, I hadn't been to London for a long time, but when I was preparing to come down for Nokia World last year, and I used just Google Street View, which is comparatively primitive now compared to all this, and it was great. I knew the areas in London I was going to go to, and I was actually able to rehearse the areas that I was going to be walking around. So like, it would be, and it really did, by the time I got there, it felt as if I had already been there. So I'd been able to step into virtual reality and find my way around a strange city.
Yeah, to talking of mapping, there's also, people might be interested to know, a new version of Ovi Maps. This is not official in the sense that it's not formally released, but Ovi Maps 3.7 is now out for Symbian 3 devices, at least via Nokia Beta Labs. Some reports have said it's rather unstable, so the usual caveats to apply with regard to testing beta software. Basically, they modularize, if that's spelled that word right, Ovi Maps into four key components: maps, drive, check-in and guides. And these four are then taken out of the traditional Ovi Maps front menu screen out onto the home screen of your device. So basically, they're taking the various elements of maps and integrating them all with the whole operating system, with the Symbian 3 interface. Other improvements, there's better search, there's a redesign for their places page. You actually get location-based advertising. I'm not sure whether that's good or bad. I guess it'll go either way. Integration of weather now into the main guides module. And there's new voice files for navigation. So there's a whole load of improvements, a whole different paradigm for accessing Ovi Maps. I know, Rafe, you did a bang-up job writing this up for the site. Any impressions after a week of use?
Yeah, no, I quite enjoyed this new view. I mean, at first I was a bit sceptical, but I think the way to explain this is that, you know, previously Ovi Maps was just a kind of a single application site where you went to get location. What this does is to make it more generally available. And you talked about the home screen there. You also get the individual icons in this, the app launcher as well. But rather than having a kind of a silo approach, it becomes more like a service in that it's available everywhere. I mean, that's a slight, slightly further than it's actually gone, but you can clearly see the way it's heading. And it's also the idea that you'll be able to get maps from other applications as well. And so the idea that rather than be a sort of application silo, it's a sort of contextual service layer, and it's a rather complicated way of explaining what's actually quite a simple complex. But I also talked about that kind of with the OmniMap 3D we're just talking about, you know, location as almost a service rather than being regarded as a separate application, because it's a task that you might want to use to do many things. I mean, in terms of actual practical use, I rather like this because, for example, you're able to dive straight into drive mode, which is actually a much more sensible way of doing things because it requires fewer clicks, it's less hassle. So you click the drive icon, you select the location, and away you go. You know, it's just a few steps, and it's much faster when you get into the car and put it in the cradle or whatever you do. And similarly, I think it also encourages the users, some of the bits of OmniMap that maybe been neglected, and specifically things like location checking. That's some people like it, some people don't, that's okay. But more significantly for me, it's the guide. So you hit the guides, and it, you know, obviously knows where you are from the GPS and will present you with the appropriate list of guides. And this was previously available under kind of the more or the extras menu in Ovi Maps. And so this is things like Lonely Planet or Quipe or Michelin or Travel Guru, all these kind of things, including weather, including sort of event information. And that's actually, I think, kind of a much more effective way of presenting location sensitive information. And actually that's, as I say, where the kind of location advertising that you referred to is coming in, also on the kind of the new places pages that have been reworked. And again, they pull information together from all of these sources to actually create a database of places that's actually pretty comprehensive and has a lot of information. You know, they can have galleries in terms of pictures, they can have reviews from users as well as entries from all the travel guides, and, you know, of course that links in, you can call them, you can navigate to them, you can see them on the map, etc., etc. So it's almost a complete reworking of, as you put it, the structure of OmniMaps, and I actually think this is pretty effective. It makes it more usable. So I'm definitely a fan of this new approach. I mean, some people have liked it less, but I think, you know, once you actually try this out, it works better than having everything in a single application. I think that reflects the way smartphones are going in general. You know, the application paradigm is almost something that came to us from, you know, PDAs and computers. Yet on a smartphone, you tend to be carrying out a specific task or having an experience, and that's less suited to the application model. So I think OmniMaps is, you know, quite pioneering in that sense, albeit it still has to sit within the framework of application, things like that. But I think when you're using it, you think of it less that way and more of, as I say, a service that you use to do a specific task from wherever you happen to be in the phone.
I'm one of those people that's not completely enamored of this, not because of the modularity approach. I think that's a really nice idea. It's the fact that they've taken functionality away from the older version. For people who are going to be coming to their phone and experiencing OmniMaps for the first time, they're not going to know any different. They're going to realize that if you're in the maps icon and you click on an icon, you don't actually have a bit that says check in until you actually start scrolling through. It just seems to me that somebody who's updating to this is going to feel slightly confused and that they've lost something. Now, having been through and sat down and had a look through, nothing is lost. It's just that everything's put into different places. It really feels like a compatibility break. And I'm wondering, you know, 3.6 to 3.7, this feels like it should be more of a version jump. And that's why I'm in two minds about it, Rafe. Not because of the functionality, I think the functionality is great, but the fact that it's losing something and it's just putting different hoops and there's more clicks to get to check in or less clicks depending on what way you. I just find it quite confusing why they've done it this way.
I do agree with you that there's an issue for existing users with familiarity, but I don't think inertia is an excuse not to change things, because I think this approach is better. But there is a sort of learning curve that people have to go through. And when we talk about this being modular, we should emphasize that actually all the separate things are interlinked together, so it's not like they're completely sitting in isolation. You know, so when you search in a guide for a place, you find a place, you can then launch drive mode or map mode very easily, and it's completely seamless. So, you know, it's not like launching a separate application, it just happens. That kind of division is an artificial one, as we describe it, but actually in practice they are still all linked together quite closely.
Indeed, yes, and you're right that inertia should not be a barrier, but at the same time, you said that it needs to be a learning curve. Well, tell the people that they need to do some learning. Maybe guide the older users to where the new stuff is, rather than them relying on them spending 5 or 10 minutes exploring the application. By all means, update, but show the upgrade path. Don't just go, right, learn a new way of doing things, because so much of a smartphone is personal and muscle memory and remembering where things are rather than looking at the screen. And this update destroys all that and doesn't give you an easy way to learn again.
And just picking up on the weather point, I think there's an interesting trick that I think is being missed. I mean, it's all very well putting in a location and then getting a forecast. However, when it comes to the current weather, I think I'm surprised that no one's actually put in like a TV weather report style and actually trying to replace the TV weather report. I mean, if say if it's a Sunday and you're trying to decide where to go, it'd be nice if you could just bring up a map of the UK and look at the patch of coast that's nearest to you and see who's going to get the good weather.
I'm very much looking forward to seeing whether the Nokia Maps finally knows where I am in the world, and not from the GPS point of view, but when I've been going into guides recently with Obimap 3.6, it keeps insisting I'm in Wales. And nothing against Wales whatsoever. There's some very nice people in Wales, but I don't want to find out all about Wales. It's not relevant to me in Berkshire, in England, Nokia. So for them to actually get the country wrong is rather embarrassing. I'm hoping 3.7 will fix that. I will report back. In due course, the reports of the 3.7 being unstable no doubt will lead to another beta of 3.7 before it finally gets rolled out as a fully published item. Rafe, one last point from you.
Just to emphasise, this is a beta, so we've been talking about this, and it's quite clear that all of us have tried it and probably aren't having too many problems with it. But be careful when you're installing it. And some of the issues that Ewan was saying there, I think, sort of beta awareness, and particularly if I sort of throw the cat amongst the pigeons and say, well, imagine this is the first version of Ovimaps that appears on Windows Phone, so therefore the transition break may not be quite as severe for some people as we're talking about, or rather it will be in amongst the transition of an altogether bigger scale. But yes, just emphasising that beta point, please do be careful, but if you do try it and you've got some feedback, make sure you submit it to Nokia Beta Lab so everyone can benefit from it.
Yeah, the timescale for Nokia Maps 3.6 to be fully published was in the order of months. So, and this has only just come out, so I wouldn't expect a formal release of 3.7 until at least at a June, July time. And it may end up being 3.8, which gets formally published and pushed out through software update and through various other over-the-air means. So, treat it very much with kid gloves. Nokia and Microsoft, we mentioned earlier, have signed this definitive agreement now for Windows Phone. They quoted it as being creating a new global mobile ecosystem. That was announced in February. It's now been signed, and they'll continue to work together, quote, each bringing their own strengths to the table, seeking to combine their complementary assets. So I guess it's all done and dusted, Rafe. There are no more roadblocks to this all happening.
Well, the roadblocks are that they've actually now got to work on the implementation. They did actually say that's well on the way, with hundreds of engineers across both Nokia and Microsoft already working on this. And one of the interesting tidbits was that they've actually shown off a device to their internal sales team at sort of the global meeting that they have every year. Obviously, that would be a very early kind of prototype device. But Stephen Elop did say in this kind of results call that actually they were finding that they're able to bring the device to the market much quicker than they had on their previous platforms. And so that does mean that hopefully the 2012 timescale is absolutely going to be met, and hopefully we may see a device in 2011 as well. I think there's probably a couple of things we should emphasize here. I mean, you talked about the agreement itself. It's been structured into four broad areas. The first obvious point is, yes, Nokia will be licensing Windows Phone, and Microsoft will, as a result, receive a royalty from Nokia. But there was some interesting bits in that the royalty payments will reflect the large volumes Nokia expects to ship. In other words, they're going to be getting a discount for buying more licenses than everyone else. And it's also going to take into account that the engineering work which both companies are committed to, and that means that Nokia is going to be putting significant engineering resources towards the platform, and obviously that will be offset against royalty payments, etc., etc. I think the interesting issue here is that Nokia is clearly going to be paying less than the $15 a device that people like Samsung and HTC are paying, and that's going to give them a competitive advantage. So I wonder how happy Samsung and HTC will be about that, because it will be harder for them to compete on a cost basis. In terms of the sort of second part of it, we got some details on how they're going to combine the assets together. So Nokia are going to be delivering the mapping, navigation, location stuff onto the Windows Phone ecosystem. I think that effectively means we'll see Ovi maps on Windows Phone. They're going to also, Nokia, going to help in hardware design and language support. That's things like localization, and particularly, I think, in driving Windows Phone to the lower cost devices where Nokia has a lot of expertise, a lot of experience. And so there'll be a lower cost chassis specification, it's known, in Windows Phone to drive these kind of $150, $200 devices compared to the $300, $400 we have on Windows Phone at the moment. Then, of course, you'll be having the Microsoft services like Bing arriving on the Nokia device portfolio, but you'll also get that in terms of productivity, Office and Exchange, advertising, ad center, and gaming for Xbox. They were quite clear in saying that the navigation and location assets combined together might open up new revenue stream. You know, being that this was a sort of briefing to financial analysts, revenue becomes important. Also, talking about developers, one of the questions we asked early on is who's going to own the developer, and the answer seems to be that they're determined to sort of have joint ownership, so there's going to be joint developer activities, and they're going to support them at the creation of new local and global applications. Translated, that means both Nokia and Microsoft want to have contact with the developers, I think. In terms of some of the more money transfers, it's interesting to hear that there's going to be payments to Nokia in billions of dollars, reflecting the unique nature of Nokia's agreement with Microsoft and the contributions that they're providing. That's a quote there. So that essentially, that's the cost that Nokia's asked Microsoft to pay in order to make this switch. But there's also a second payment, which is relating to intellectual property rights, that's patents and all those other things. And that's recognizing that Nokia has by far and away the dominant sort of position here in terms of intellectual property around the mobile space when compared to Microsoft. So that's quite interesting. So I think the net effect of that is actually probably going to be there's not that much net transfer of money in either direction by the time we've taken in these various payments into account. And that really reflects the fact that both companies want to work together. I should just mention there's one thing I missed off the end of that sort of complementary assets, and that was talking about the application store. And again, this was a question mark we had, but it looks like there's going to be a Nokia-branded global application store built on the Windows market infrastructure. So I suspect that means we'll see something like Ovi Store. Whether it will retain that name is still open to debate, but it will be Nokia-branded rather than the Windows marketplace. And I think that's pretty significant in terms of one of the key touch points with consumers is developers and consumer applications. And Nokia is clearly of a mind there to remain leading. And it says there's going to be one portal through which developers can submit their applications for Windows Phone, for Symbian and Series 40. So, there was a question whether by backing off from developing their own software, would Nokia be giving up that kind of developer differentiation? And clearly the answer is coming here. No, it's not. In fact, if anything, it's going to become more important. And they recognize how that's the strategy across all their devices. So I think it actually reflects that Nokia is in quite a strong position in this partnership, at least from that point of view. And no doubt the sort of points of this will continue to be debated. But it was interesting to see this get announced. And interestingly, both Nokia and Microsoft said this was slightly ahead of schedule. I think they're going to have to keep up that track record and deliver things ahead of schedule if they're to keep both consumers and the sort of the financial markets happy.
Now, Rev, just the wording of these announcements always leaves me wanting clarification.
That's the lawyers for you.
Yes.
It almost sounds like it's spoken by a lawyer as well.
Well, also, I'm just thinking about Navtec and intellectual property. How exclusive is a Navtec mapping going to be? I mean, i.e., are other Windows Phone OEMs going to be able to use the Navtec data? Because it is going to go into Bing search. So in a sense, that's diluting Nokia's ownership in a sense, because other people are benefiting. And this intellectual property rights agreement, is it just that the agreement that Microsoft can use those patents, or are they actually effectively giving over the rights to Microsoft?
What this is in terms of patent, it's cross-licensing, which means they're giving each other the right to use each other's patents. And in this particular case, Microsoft is actually going to be paying money in order to be able to do that. And these kind of cross-licensing agreements are very common. And these are usually the way all the patent disputes, when various companies suing each other are solved. It doesn't mean they're giving up anything. It's really just about giving a license to use that particular patent. So I wouldn't characterize it as giving up in any way. And similarly with Navtech, it certainly looks like it's being donated to the, or donated is the wrong word, it's being licensed to the Windows Phone ecosystem. So yes, you will get Navtech data on other Windows Phone devices and quite possibly OmniMats. Now, whether it gets renamed or not, that remains to be seen. And I suspect that was one of the harder bits for Nokia Swallow, because it is a competitive advantage. At the same time, as we said before, I think Nokia will probably become the predominant Windows Phone licensee or provider. And I think, you know, in time it will even become synonymous that Nokia is Windows Phone, etc., and sort of vice versa. It'll be interesting to see how HTC and Samsung respond in the long term. But in certain markets, it's certainly going to be true that you will only be able to buy a Nokia Windows Phone device simply because the others don't have the kind of the reach in terms of the logistics and the retail chain. But yes, as I read it, it is saying that you will get the Navtech data and Ovi Maps on other Windows Phone devices as well as obviously the Nokia ones.
Microsoft just had a big conference of their own, and one of the things they showed off was Windows Phone 7.5, which is the new name for what was Mango. All their code names end in O. The previous one was Nodo, which had just been applied to many of the Windows Phone 7 devices, which some of us have been trying out. And I've been trying it here on the HTC 7 Mozart. And what many, all of our Symbian readers want to know is how far along is Windows Phone in terms of how much of the current functionality they get under Symbian can be replaced by Windows Phone 7. Currently, not that much, really. I have to say, I really enjoyed using the 7 Mozart. I've enjoyed using the HTC 7 before it. Windows Phone 7 has got a lot going for it in the UI. I can feel you and blood pressure rising here. I really enjoyed using the 7 Mozart, but at every turn, every 5 minutes, I came across something. Oh, on Symbian, I simply Bluetooth that file there. On Symbian, I simply plug it into my desktop and drag the file off. At every turn, I was frustrated. Now, the Windows Phone 7.5 will bring third-party multitasking. Knowing Nokia's involvement, it will bring some degree of mass storage, some degree of being able to plug your phone into your desktop and actually access files. So these things will hopefully all be solved, and at the end of it, we'll have a really nice UI as well. But this is very much in a wait-and-see state at the moment. Ewan?
Yes, I'm going to jump in there. First of all, let's just stress, we are only guessing that mass storage is coming because of Nokia's involvement. We have no knowledge of whether that is or not. So let's just keep that stressed. Let's tie this back with keeping my blood pressure aside and trying to be clinical about it. Earlier we talked about mapping becoming more services than applications. And I think this is what Windows Phone 7, whatever, let's just call it WP for the moment, is actually good for. It is good for services. You can pop services on your home screen. You can do your UIs. I have been using Windows 7 here as well. It's the HT7 Trophy, which is basically the bog standard slab, no keyboards or anything attached to it, alongside the E7. And I have to say, yes, there are things that I would like to see going in it, but I'm not having any huge issues when I'm out and about using it for communicating. Now, as usual, I'm going to take this out in a real world near the end of May for a whole week, and if you guys don't mind, I'd like to do that with just Windows 7 and not a Symbian device, because I think that would be quite interesting for our readers. But at the same time, you know, Windows Phone 7 does what it wants to do, what it needs to do, and what it thinks the users want to do. And I think that's an important distinction. The people who are making a lot of noise about, oh, it doesn't have this, it doesn't have that from Symbian, are the people who are incredibly vocal about Symbian. Not surprisingly, people who come to a site called All About Symbian. I know that's you, but we had All About Sound for a long time as well. At the same time, I think Windows Phone has been maturing. The Nodo update really does improve the device, and it adds in a lot more things that are basic. And let's remember, both Android and iPhone started off with not having a lot of things either, and they got added on. And if we picked up the 7650 at the time, Steve, looking back at the Scion, we went, there's a lot missing on this than there were on Scion. But we're happy using the version of the operating that there is now. There is a lot of evolution to come on Windows Phone, and I know that people are now reaching out and their blood pressures are rising and writing apologist, and yes, given a straight choice between you can have the E7 or one of the Windows Phone devices, I am going to run for the E7 at this point in time. But to create such a black and white, it's nowhere near functional, I think is a great disservice to the team at Redmond, and also, you know, it is usable. You mean, Steve, if we dropped you off in the middle of nowhere with just a Windows Phone, you'd be quite happy with it?
I would, but the problem comes when I encounter another user and I can't Bluetooth them a file. The problem comes when I arrive back at civilization.
That's what SkyDrive is for.
So Windows Phone 7 is a wonderful little cloud smartphone.
Yes, and philosophical thing. You hit it right on the head there. Windows 7, it specifically says so in the developer documentation that at every point in time, developers are asked to consider and default to the cloud. It is a connected, always-on device. Symbian, as philosophy, was always it's offline and can go online when it needs to. Windows Phone is always online, and that's where your connectivity, that's where your sharing files comes in, that's where your social stuff comes in. It is a different philosophy of devices, and I think that's what's getting you around. It's trying to ask who's right in two religions, and you think the other one's wrong. It's not. It just depends on which one you want to believe in, whether you just think people should be nailed to trees and stuff.
Rafe, do you want to be a peacemaker?
Well, I was just going to say, actually, I think that's quite an informative way of looking at it, the kind of division between online and offline. Clearly that's an oversimplification, but yes, I do feel, having used Windows Phone, that does represent, you know, the shift that we're seeing. And I think actually that in one sense describes quite neatly some of the issues that Symbian has been facing, that in one sense the goalposts have moved, the world has moved on from the kind of the constrained devices towards something that's expected to be connected to the cloud all the time. Now that's going to have some very interesting implications for certain market segments and certain markets where that kind of always on is less of an apparent thing. I think in the States and increasingly in Western Europe, that's kind of an expectation. In some places that's not so true. I think the issue that we are talking about with missing functionality, what we're going to see, I think, with Windows Phone is some people incredibly frustrated, you know, with their missing Bluetooth file transfer or whatever it happens to be. And there will be many, many different things that you can put into that particular gap. But what we'll see is that over time, Windows Phone will gain a certain amount of extra functionality. We'll see different priorities coming in. But unquestionably, to my mind, there is going to be a gap of anything up to 12 months, maybe even longer, as we, you know, wait for Windows Phone 8 or whatever version it happens to be to come along to sort of fill in some of those gaps. And that's at both the developers when they feel that there's APIs missing, they can't implement the application they want to, or consumers missing a particular bit of functionality. And I think the critical period for both Nokia and Microsoft will be ensuring that that sort of gap where people feel that there's stuff missing is as small as possible and is thought to be missing by as small a number of people as possible. And obviously, as the version numbers go upwards, I think the number of people thinking there's something missing will go down. And that intersection on the graph, if you like, is the critical point and will be one of the key performance indicators for how Nokia and Microsoft work together. But I do particularly like this idea of sort of, you know, a cloud or online first versus sort of offline or phone centric, whichever way you want to think about it. That is a very useful way to think about the different philosophies behind the two platforms and, you know, which one you prefer. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this saying, I actually prefer the offline one. But I don't think anyone would doubt that the world is moving towards kind of the cloud and the web and always on connected. We've seen the same thing happen with desktop computers. The idea of using one of those without an internet connection now is probably a pretty alien concept to most people.
Sure. David, you had the last comment.
Yes, because my blood pressure spiked, so I have to do something about it, I'm afraid. Yes, I have to relieve myself. I'm fine with the idea of a cloud phone. In a sense, I'm already doing that. I mean, for example, sharing a file up to Dropbox is actually a lot less hassle than it is Bluetooth not plugging in a USB cable. So I'm fine with that. The thing that bothers me is that, and it's something I've been thinking a lot about lately, is that platforms and ecosystems do seem to be inseparable, and it's hard to bringing another ecosystem onto a given platform. Amazon are trying it on Android, for example. But it's the idea of having a Windows phone and having to use a Microsoft cloud. That troubles me. I want to be able to choose which cloud I'm going to use. So, we'll have to wait and see how liberal the and for Windows Phone App Store is. But it's just, I want to choose which cloud ecosystem I'm going to use. I don't want to have to be locked into the Microsoft.
I think that's an interesting point, because it's the kind of the utopian view that you want the ideal. I think for a lot of consumers, they won't actually care that much. And I think what we'll see is actually kind of a hybrid between the two. So some things you'll be able to access from any platform. You know, email is a great example. You know, obviously it'll be Gmail or Hotmail, and each platform will want to make those accessible regardless of, you know, what you're using. But I think for some of the things like application stores, they are clearly going to be linked quite heavily to the platform or the ecosystem that you're on. And in one sense, there's an irony here that, you know, people always saw, you know, the cloud and the internet as a way to get away from kind of locked in platforms. But I think that will apply just as much, particularly on mobile, because, you know, you will be locked into your particular ecosystem. And I think in one sense, there's going to be a competitive advantage to whichever platform can make their ecosystem sort of open and as flexible as possible and sort of draw in elements of others where possible. But there's clearly going to be a fight in some cases where people don't want to open up as much as others might want to. And you can see that with something like Facebook, you know, or, you know, who owns the identity. We've seen that between Google and Facebook. I think that's the thing will get extended onto mobile as well. You know, Microsoft and Nokia each have their own identity plays as well. So it's going to become increasingly complicated as we see these things. You know, it won't be this great expression of openness that some people seem to think goes hand in hand with the web. There will be a certain amount of lock-in and walled gardens. And part of me, a big part of me goes, ooh, that's horrible. But on the other hand, if it creates a consumer experience that is very smooth and just worked, you know, most people will be perfectly happy with that. And obviously the ultimate demonstration of that at the moment is kind of the iTunes and the Apple ecosystem, which is locked down, which is a walled garden. But there's a lot of people quite happily playing about in the walled garden. And it's the, shall I say, the geeks like David who are sort of sitting on top of the wall, staring at abject horror, being unable to decide which side of the wall they want to jump onto.
No, I'm sorry if I'm going to have to vehemently object to that. Point of order.
Yeah, they don't have walls in Hull.
They don't have you gardens in Hull.
You and I'll have a word with you after the show. Right, okay. It's not just the utopian open vision. There is an actual practical concern, because when it comes to sharing files or updating contacts, there's a social element, which means there's a critical mass consideration. For example, if I want to share a file with someone, I'm more likely to do it on Dropbox, because Dropbox is the de facto file storage system, even though it's been found to be insecure lately. So if I'm using a Windows phone, and I'm stuck to sharing my files with SkyDrive, I can't get my files to anyone else because I don't know anyone else who's using SkyDrive. So I don't want to be locked into using that system. And similarly, I think the Windows Live ecosystem had a great, were the first to the punch with something which I think is a great idea, and that being your address book. You don't add someone to your address book, you subscribe to someone's details. And then when they update their details, everyone who has subscribed to their contact details gets the update, which means your address book is constantly updated by the people who are in your address book. Brilliant idea. But again, how many people do I know in my ecosystem? Not enough to make me use it.
Now that's an absolutely fair point. This is why I said actually the hybrid approach will be the one that's most competitive. And you're talking about Dropbox there. Clearly, you know, the way to do this hybrid thing most obviously is through the application store, and so you have a Dropbox application available. In terms of the stuff that comes out of the box, that's where you're going to see the more obvious ecosystem divide, but that's going to be very much mitigated by services and applications available through the application stores. And I think, you know, that's why that developer element, that application, or as Steve Barn would have it, developers, is going to be so critical, because actually that's going to be that marries up, you know, what the sort of ecosystem provides by default with actually what people want. Because, you know, not surprisingly, most people actually have services that, you know, encompass many different ecosystems. You know, they have a Windows computer, but they have an iPod, or, you know, they have their photos on Flickr, or, as you say, Dropbox and whatever. And so, as I say, it is that hybrid approach. So I was, you know, talking with a pinch of salt about walled gardens and all of that. Actually, perhaps it's better to talk about, you know, a garden that is perforated by holes provided by the application store.
And look, let me pop in just on some of those questions, David. First of all, Dropbox is this month's de facto standard for cloud. I mean, if you think about it, you've got Ovi, you've got Apple, you've got Android, Google. Facebook arguably is your cloud. Dropbox, Amazon with their EC2 and Flex Storage, some other stuff in there. And your own email box is in the cloud. Remember, the cloud is just a technical term for stuff that's online. And yes, I will take your point on the Windows Live not having a huge number of people in that system. But Windows Phone have already addressed that. You log in, you give it your Facebook details as well, and whack, my address book was suddenly filled. Everybody's thumbnails, address and phone numbers that people wanted to share were already there. The integration to Twitter is already promised for the Windows Phone 7.5 update, so there'll be even more integration. There's three clouds straight off. If I call up a picture and say, right, where do I go? I can send it via messaging, which is basically MMS, SMS, and such like. My Hotmail account, my Gmail account, I can upload to Facebook, I can upload to SkyDrive. I think that the walled garden in Windows Phone is a sort of walled garden that you would get in a 1950s Just William book, where it's very easy to lob a football over, jump in and steal some apples and scrump it away. So I think your fears are founded, but they're very much the fears of someone who probably has a Linux desktop.
Ouch.
I think we must finish there, guys. We're running way long. I'm going to start handing out Valium to the team to just calm them down, ready for the rest of the day's work. In the meantime, we're out of time, so we will catch you next week. You can find us on Twitter at AAS, also at Steve Litchfield, at Rafe Blanford, at Ewan, and at David Gilson. Goodbye from the team in Sussex.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye up in Scotland.
Good dog.
Leaving David till last. Goodbye from David.
Goodbye, everybody.
Oh, and David, just what, you wanted to plug your reviews, didn't you? Go on.
Oh, I thought it was out of time. Okay, if you've been using a Symbian phone for a long time and you've been having trouble with album art and you just can't get your album art to show up, there is a great application in the Ovi store now called CoverUp, which will scan your music collection and pull art down from Amazon and fix the problem finally. And it's only costs a pound.
Yeah, highly recommended. I've been using it as well. But that is goodbye from us. You will catch us next week on the All About Symbian Insight podcast. Bye for now.